Hey everyone, well, welcome to Stutter Talk at episode 713 for February 7th, 2022. I am Peter Reitzes here with host and today's guest, Dr. Christopher Constantino. Hey Chris, how's it going?
Hi Peter, nice to be talking to you.
It is great to be talking with you. This is the Is It Stuttering If the House Is Not on Fire edition. Chris Constantino is a speech language pathologist and assistant professor at Florida State University. Chris co-edited the highly acclaimed book, Stammering, Pride, and Prejudice. I am Peter Reitzes, a speech language pathologist in North Carolina and president of Stutter Talk. We are both people who stutter. So Chris, recently I've been contacted by several speech language pathologists about stuttering in the schools. And sometimes all I have to do is scratch the surface just a little bit to find out that the only person concerned about stuttering is the speech language pathologist, is the SLP. So for example, the SLP is called upon to conduct a speech language screening as part of a larger evaluation. And just for the listeners who may not know, if a child is suspected to have a disability, such as a learning disability, a speech language screening is required, which would look at language, stuttering, voice, articulation. And during this screening process, the SLP hears a little something. So the parent is not concerned about stuttering, the classroom teacher is not concerned about possible stuttering, but the SLP hears some disfluency that may or may not be stuttering. So now the SLP is on a quest to determine if this is stuttering, which is when they contact me. So before I continue, Chris, what are your thoughts so far?
Just that this is something that I've also come across being in the school system, that whether or not a young child is stuttering can often feel like a mystery. And the SLP often seems to be like the person who's most concerned about getting to the bottom of this mystery.
So I agree with you in large part. I would just take a step back, and my guess is we would totally agree that when a parent contacts us about possible stuttering, the parent, in my experience, is almost always correct. Like the parent tends to contact us, not always, but often when their house is on fire, when they feel helpless, when they know their child's stuttering and they don't know what to do. Thoughts, Chris?
Yeah, I think that's a really important caveat. I would say that if anybody in the child's life, who's normally in the child's life, their teacher, their parent, the child themselves is concerned about stuttering, then usually I'm concerned too. But if it's like you're describing, where nobody else is concerned, then I'm typically much less so. And I agree with you that parents are, and research has backed this up, that parents are very often good diagnosticians when it comes to stuttering.
And this actually happens, I think, quite a bit. So this school year, I have received three contacts, emails, which I get an email and I always say, let's talk on the phone. And this school year, I have been contacted three times that they're pretty much the same situation, where the teacher does not come to you with concerns about stuttering. The parent does not contact you or the teacher about possible stuttering. But the speech language pathologist in the schools does a speech and language screening on a child who is not suspected of stuttering. And the speech language pathologist says, I hear some stuttering. I hear some disfluency. You know, I gave the stuttering severity instrument, Peter, which is a commonly used stuttering count, stuttering measure, and I'm not sure if this is stuttering. Can you help me score it? And so it's a little frustrating when you realize that the professional is relying upon how they score a measure to determine if a child stutters, but it's also not their fault. So, I mean, I'm frustrated for a moment, and then I realize I really need to help this fellow colleague who's really trying to do their best. And recently I've been saying to them, Chris, and I'd love your feedback on this, I'll say to them, well, usually when we consider a child for defining them, finding them eligible for services as a person who stutters, usually the house is on fire. Usually the child is having great difficulty communicating, or perhaps they don't want to communicate. The family feels helpless, and you know, one moment their child seems to be speaking fine, and the next moment the child's stuttering and they don't know what to do. The teacher's frustrated because the child may not participate, or may participate but have great trouble getting their thoughts out. So I find myself saying to the speech language pathologist, is the house on fire? What are your thoughts again, Chris?
I like that approach to thinking about services, because I think something that I think we often forget as speech language pathologists is that even though our job is to prioritize speech and language, that everybody has lots of other priorities in their life. And given the nature of how time and attention works, you can't prioritize everything. Choosing to increase something in priority means necessarily that you decrease something else, right? Time is a zero sum game. And so having somebody take part in unnecessary therapy, I don't think the therapy necessarily does harm, but you are, especially in a school setting, possibly taking them out of a classroom for longer than they need to be out of a classroom for. And so being conservative in whether we give a child services, I think does them justice. I have a nuance, like a little wrinkle to that, that I want to add though. And that is that when I was in a school setting and I had a sort of similar situations where the child didn't seem concerned, it didn't seem like that big of a deal that they were stuttering. Because of the way services in schools work, that you have, it's, everything's very formal and requires paperwork. I was often inclined, if I really thought it was stuttering, to go ahead with the diagnosis, just if I thought that was an accurate diagnosis, and put them on consultation, which means they're not receiving direct services. As their SLP, I might check in with them and their teacher a few times a month to make sure everything's going okay for them, that they don't need services or direct services. But the reason I would do that is so that I could give them accommodations, or that they could get accommodations sometime in the future that might help them if they start to experience difficulties. And what I like about them having the IEP, for those of you who haven't worked in the schools, that's an individualized education program. Any child who is receiving additional services for a disability receives what they call an IEP, which is a federal document that says they're entitled to these services. And what I like about the IEP is it empowers the student and their family to say that we're not asking the teacher for these accommodations, but we're entitled to them. And I think that puts the ball in their side of the court a little bit.
Those are excellent points. Tell me if you agree with this. It sounds like we're talking about two related and also different things. So one, the child may not be stuttering and the speech language pathologist might accidentally find the child eligible for stuttering. And two, the child may be stuttering, but we are unsure if it is disabling in the academic setting. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
So sticking with the first one, for both of them. So if the child is not stuttering, or if the child may be stuttering, but it's not disabling or may not be disabling, I find myself mentioning a few things to a team, to the parent. Is your child a disabled speaker? And that the answer to that will tell you a lot. And so often the parent will say, oh, my heavens, no, my child is not a disabled speaker. They're doing great in school. They love going to school. They love talking. And then you could follow that up as, well, is your child's speech holding them back in the classroom? And what you often, not always, hear back is, oh, no, they raise their hand all the time. And the teacher might joke, I can't get them to stop talking. At which point you could say, I'm going to suggest to the team, I'm not sure we should be considering stuttering at this point. Because even if this child is stuttering, what the evidence you all are explaining to me is that it is not disabling. And so you walk a family and a school team through this, and it makes a lot of sense when what I'm saying is all accurate. Do you have any thoughts on that, or is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's a really nice nuance for how to think about services for children who stutter. Because I don't think just having a stutter means you have to be in therapy, right? It does. It's not necessarily disabling, right? It could just be the way that they speak and they're happy with it and everybody else is happy with it. And so let's just carry on. I think that does... It puts some space and makes a distinction between having a stutter and being disabled, right? As like needing some sort of intervention. I don't think those two are necessarily the same thing.
I agree. And so I just turned 50. And I find myself, I mean, I've always thought of myself as direct, but I find myself being more and more direct. And when we are considering a child for possible services and eligibility as a child who stutters, and for lack of a better term, we could say the child may be stuttering a little. It doesn't mean that stuttering could be a little problem, but the child's not presenting as having difficulty with speech, but they may be stuttering a little. And, you know, I will say out loud sometimes, you know, my role is to help disabled speakers academically participate in school, but I'm not the perfect speech police. And I've never had that go wrong. It's always the intent is to explain we're not about expecting perfection. We're about having a child feel comfortable communicating, want to come to school, want to talk in class. And I find that speaking to families and special education teams like this is helpful. Have you found such language helpful, or what do you think of such language like we're not the perfect speech police?
I think actually families often find that relieving. Especially if this isn't their first time encountering speech language pathology, right? They may have been pursuing perfect speech for a while now, and to have that burden lifted from them, I think can often be a relief. If this is their first time, right? This is the first time anybody's brought it to their attention. The fact that they don't need to worry about it, I think, is also often helpful, right? As I was just talking earlier about priorities, people are already worrying about a lot of different things, and stuttering doesn't necessarily need to be one of them.
Agreed.
Thank you.
This is Stutter Talk. I am Peter Reitzis here with Dr. Christopher Constantino. We are both people who stutter and speech language pathologists. Chris is well known for his research, for his work, and his writing on covert stuttering, and for his wonderful column from a few years back, Stuttering Gain, which we'll be talking about on the next Stutter Talk episode. Chris, a couple more things here. So in the past, I have joked that stuttering is like being pregnant. There's no such thing as kind of stuttering. There's no such thing as being kind of pregnant, right? If you're kind of pregnant, you're having a baby in 9 months. But I'm starting to rethink that. Do you think it's possible there's an in-between that you could kind of stutter? Or that stuttering, I'll take it the next step, that stuttering can exist but is not a disability.
So to address both of those, I think I'm in complete agreement with the second. Mm-hmm. I'm open to the first.
And so by the way, I'm so sorry. I am also open to the first. I'm not selling it. I'm just asking.
Right. I think as a field, we spent decades trying to get people to understand that stuttering is not a matter of quantity of disfluencies, but quality of disfluencies, right? That what a person who stutters experiences is fundamentally different from a typically fluent speaker stumbling over their words, right? That there is a subjective experience that accompanies stuttering. We often call it feeling like you're losing control or getting stuck, that fluent speakers, even when they're disfluent, are not experiencing. Right? So that's been something I think there's been a lot of misunderstanding about. And so it's become dogma in how we talk about stuttering. And so the idea that somebody might kind of stutter, doesn't quite fit into that dogma. But like I said earlier, I'm open to the idea that there might be shades of experience and that perhaps somebody has increased typical disfluencies, but don't experience that loss of control I don't know that it has to fit so neatly into our pedagogical explanations of what stuttering is. So yeah, I'm open to the idea that it's not so black and white.
Yeah, I am too. And I'm thinking of many things, but of being in the pool over the summer. And, you know, the pool's loud and it's disorienting at times. And hearing a child playing with my children and hearing some disfluency and, you know, the stuttering radar goes off. And realizing in the pool, I'm not sure if this child stutters or not. And then a few weeks later, when the mom finds out I'm a speech language pathologist, she says, oh, we're having such a time. My child stutters. But the speech language pathologist is saying, oh, that's a trait of autism, because the son's also autistic. It's not real stuttering. I mean, that whole conversation makes sense. And, you know, if I were evaluating the child, I would do a careful evaluation. But just hearing the child speak in bits and pieces in the pool, I immediately thought, this sounds like stuttering. And then the mom pretty much confirmed it, said, oh, he stutters. It's a problem. But we also have a problem where the speech language pathologist doesn't think it's stuttering. They think it's autism, or they think it's related to his autism and learning disabilities. Have you experienced anything like this?
Well, it reminds me, and surely you've had this experience too, because I think all people who stutter do, is you telling somebody that you stutter and then they telling you, oh, I stutter sometimes too. And then you talk about it a little bit, and it's clear that when they're using the word stutter, they don't mean the same thing you mean, right? It's not like they get stuck in blocks that they then have to work to get past. And I think as people who think of themselves as authentic stutterers, we sort of dismiss the experience that they're talking about. Mm-hmm. But perhaps we shouldn't, right? Perhaps just because their experience is different from ours, it doesn't mean it's any less real or any less present in their attention. It might just be a different experience with disfluencies than we have.
Mm. Very interesting. Let me bring up one other, a couple things. Just taking a step back, when the speech-language pathologist, very well-intentioned, is the only one who has a concern about stuttering, and this has happened two or three times this year, where they say, I'm scoring the stuttering severity instrument, and I'm stuck. And they're basically stuck. Are they going to make this child a stutterer by this piece of paper they have in their lap? And I'm remembering being in graduate school and sitting in a room, and three or four of us graduate clinicians were listening to the same language sample on videotape, and we all scored the stuttering severity instrument differently. And the expectation was we would come out with very similar scores, but we did not. And so there's so much in my experience, there's so much subjectivity if you're using a piece of paper to tell you if a child stutters or not. Do you have any experiences like that?
It's not just your experience. I mean, that's what research shows too, right? That if you compare labs, people within a laboratory who train together and who purposely count together and talk about moments of disfluency and make group decisions about whether that's a moment of stuttering or just a moment of typical disfluency, they can get pretty accurate together. But that requires time and effort and training. Whereas if you compare across laboratories, accuracy is often very poor, right? That people are rating these differently and making different guesses about what's a stutter and what's not. And every year that I teach my stuttering class, I have my students do some counting, and we talk about how different our scores are, right? And these are students who are all taught by the same teacher, right? I'm their teacher, and I don't try to reconcile those differences. I let that be an example of how subjective this is, that the only person who really knows whether it was a stutter is the speaker. And if the speaker is 4 years old, they may not even be able to tell you or articulate what a stutter is or what isn't. And so it's very difficult to know for sure how exactly somebody else's speech is experienced. And I think this goes back to your original point about how if it's truly something we should be concerned about, the child would be having trouble, right? The child would be having difficulty communicating. They would have difficulty participating. And if they're not expressing that, if they're not observed to be struggling, then do we really have enough data to make a diagnosis? Not to suggest that if they have stuttering, they must be suffering or struggling. Like we said earlier, I think they can be stuttering and also not having a problem. But I think it makes it even less certain if they don't even seem to be aware of it.
Yeah, I agree. And so there are always exceptions. But I'm going to suggest that in my experience, if the parent, and I mean, assuming that the parent is present, you know, assuming, you know, for lack of a better term, this is a good parent, you know, if the parent is not concerned about stuttering and the classroom teacher is not concerned about stuttering, in my experience, the speech language pathologist should be should walk very carefully if they are the only ones concerned about stuttering. Do you think that's a fair general rule or guideline?
I think that's a very good rule, especially given how much we know about how variable stuttering is and the very small snippet of data that we have as a speech language pathologist, whereas the parent has much more data for whether to decide if they should be concerned or not.
Yeah, those are really excellent points. And even backtracking a lot now, sometimes I think this comes down to if the speech language pathologist understands the difference between stuttering and normal disfluency. Because if you're in a team meeting, so if you're meeting as a team and you're trying to decide if you're going to test the child at all, or if you've already done an evaluation and you're determining as a team if you're going to make the child eligible, sometimes it's helpful to say, well, you know, there's avoiding stuttering and there's covert stuttering, but many or most people who stutter at some point are going to talk like this at some point. And if the teacher and the parent and the speech language pathologist say, oh, no, he's never talked like that, then that tells you something. And I think sometimes when a speech language pathologist is doing a screening and they hear a child maybe repeat a few words, they might score that as stuttering. And then they sort of get into this, they put themselves into a professional pretzel where they're misdiagnosing stuttering, but then feel obligated to treat it. I'm keep asking the same thing. Does that make sense to you?
That makes sense to me. It also poses an interesting hypothetical question that I'd like to pose back to you. Let's say this is a child with a history of stuttering. They're a little bit older now. They are no longer being seen for stuttering. But as the SLP, you think you're hearing stuttering, but nobody else is concerned about it. Would that make you more concerned about covert stuttering?
Possibly. I mean, it all depends. So I would possibly be concerned about covert stuttering. And because it's covert, I'm very open to the possibility that we wouldn't see it, but we also know the tricks of the trade. Like we've walked in those shoes. I mean, I walked in those shoes for 20 some years. So, you know, I could miss it, but I think I would see it too.
Do you think your parents knew the extent of your covert stuttering?
No, they had no idea. And I know that I can hear my mom saying the words, "We just didn't know." And so much to their credit, when I finally said in my early 20s, "I need some help, I stutter," I remember my parents saying, "We're not fully understanding any of this, but we're going to get you the help." Please.
Did they know you stuttered when you were younger, though?
Yes, and they thought I outgrew it. And I literally have, I don't know if they're IEPs, but they were they're progress reports from the speech therapist. And it literally says, "Peter looks like a stutterer trying not to stutter." I'm not sure that was seen as a bad thing. I also remember seeing these IEP-like documents that said I was working on cancellations and pullouts, and I have zero memory of working on that. And I was only 5 or 6 years old, but are you really doing cancellations with a 5 and 6 year old who has a whole, like I had learning disabilities. Like, you know, I really doubt they were doing adult therapy with me when I was 5. But please.
No, it's, I think the ability of even younger children to hide their stuttering does introduce a wrinkle into this conversation, but it also makes me wonder if they're so committed to hiding their stuttering and they're so good at it, how receptive to therapy would they be at that point in their lives?
Oh, well, that's a whole other topic. And I love the topic. It's a great question. I wouldn't have been. I don't know about you. I mean, I wasn't ready until I felt like I had put myself in a corner and I was looking at a life of just, I was experiencing a life of just pure misery. Like for, you know, as the saying goes, I hit rock bottom. Like I didn't know if it could get any worse with my stuttering. So would you have been ready if you were in your deep covert world and somebody noticed your stuttering and said, "Hey, I see what you're doing. Can I help you with that?"
So I was never covert, but I was, I mean, covert to the point, I think everybody who stutters has covert tendencies, but I was never able to pass. But I did think that I was passing as cool, calm, and collected, if that makes sense. Like I was actively stuttering, and it was a struggle for me to speak, but I thought I was playing it off like it doesn't bother me. And I had stopped therapy when I was in fifth grade because I just didn't want to go anymore. And I resumed it again in 11th grade because of concerns from my grandmother. And I remember thinking, oh, I'm not fooling them, right? They can see that I'm still having a hard time. I thought I was playing it off like it didn't bother me. And so that, even though I wasn't passing as fluent, the realization that I wasn't fooling anybody, I think still made the idea of therapy seem reasonable to me.
Mm. Yeah, I totally get that. I remember being 18 when I was so very covert with my stuttering and I was not saying anything I wanted to say. And I feared having to speak when I was a freshman in college, and I feared having to meet anybody because I'd, you know, so where are you from? And you'd have to answer and I'd get stuck on the D in Delaware. I mean, I was just running from myself. And I remember my first real girlfriend, my 18-year-old girlfriend, and she didn't mean anything bad by it. One day I must have said, "Hey, on Saturday, do you want to do something?" And I must have stuttered on Saturday. And she said, "Oh, you mean on stutter day?" And I really think she was trying to give me an opening to talk about. She must have figured it out, right? I must have let my guard down with her. And I was so frozen, like the deer in headlights. And I didn't respond to her. I never brought it back up. I just crawled back into my hole. So, you know, there were times where people scratched the surface like that. That was one of the kinder times. But there are other times where somebody would pick up on it in high school and they would use it as something to hold against me. Like a kid I played street hockey with. He would, if, you know, we were teasing each other and I got the upper hand, he might make a stuttering joke because he knew he had figured out my secret and I would have to be silent because I wasn't going to admit on any level that I stuttered. Yeah, that sort of got me off on a tangent.
No, that's okay. Cause I think we're sort of circling around this. I think what I'm trying to get at is, even though at the start of this conversation, we were both pretty much in agreement that for the most part, we trust parents, right? Especially with young kids, about whether they're concerned about stuttering or not. But I've talked to many of my friends and research participants who pass as fluent, and the experience you're describing of them having nearly everybody in their life fooled is common, right? Of them at one point stuttering, learning to hide it. Everybody thinks they're recovered. They're still very much struggling, right? Their life is not easy. Speaking is not easy. And I'm just thinking, like, you're a speech language pathologist with not only a history of stuttering, but a history of covert stuttering. Just to play devil's advocate, let's say you see the person covert stuttering. And in this situation, the parents aren't concerned. The teachers aren't concerned.
Oh, right? I see.
We have the exact situation we've been talking about, but it's slightly different because there's a history of stuttering and you see the maneuvering going on. And I'm wondering if that would change how you respond.
So here's the thing. It definitely would. And I would definitely approach it a different way. I don't know what way that would be because this is all hypothetical. So I don't know if I would speak to the child or speak to the parent and tell them what I see and ask for the child or young adult to give me their feedback. I mean, I'd have to really figure it out. I do feel the need to say that I've been a full-time speech language pathologist for 22 years. And I worked in a school for 10 years in Brooklyn that had 1,400 children in it. So I've seen a lot of students. I have never, quote, discovered a covert stutter. So I just don't think this happens that often. It's important. Don't get me wrong. This is important. But it is somewhat hypothetical.
Also, in this situation, assuming you talk to the child or the teenager and they are having trouble, it would meet your criteria of the house being on fire.
Yes, absolutely. So if they are covert, and you know, here's another question. You can meet somebody who's covert and they will tell you their house is not on fire. And then I've talked about this a few times over the last 15 years. That's right, 15 years of stutter talk. But I remember the covert stutterer. Okay, I'm in a library in New York City. And the librarian is talking on the phone. I know it sounds crazy, right? We're in a quiet library and the librarian's holding a phone conversation for an hour and I'm hearing every word of it. And then after an hour, all of a sudden he stutters really well. And that's it. One stutter in an hour. And I go over to him and I was like, you know, hot on stuttering self-help. This was all new to me. I'd just come out of my stuttering closet. And I said, hey, I heard you stutter. I stutter too. I'd love to talk to you about it. And so it took him out for a cup of coffee and he presented a life to me. I'm not like you. Stuttering doesn't hold me back. And he's selling this bill of goods. Stuttering doesn't hold me back. And then as we kept talking, he said, you know, I really don't like my girlfriend, but it's too hard to date as a stutterer, so I'm going to stay with her. I really don't like my job, but it's too hard to go on job interviews. I really don't like my car, but you know, you go buy a car and you have to haggle, and I can't haggle. So you scratch the surface a little bit and you find out that this covert stuttering that was nothing was everything. So I'm open to the possibility that you can have covert stuttering and have it not be everything. But then why are you so covert about it? So I'm open to it. I just don't. I mean, how often do you come across somebody who's a covert stutterer and it's not everything?
Very rarely, because it takes so much effort to keep it up.
Yeah.
Like you're saying, I know a lot of this becomes automatic, but I have met in my, not in my therapy, because if people are coming to therapy, they're usually coming because they need help. But through my research, I have talked to people who stutter covertly, who seem like they're doing just fine, right? They have no intention of changing. They say that, you know, it barely takes any work for them to hide. And I would imagine those are people who, if they were not passing as fluent, would be pretty, I'll use the word mild, right? They probably wouldn't stutter very much anyway.
Yeah.
And so passing doesn't require that much effort. It'd probably require more effort to unlearn all those habits. And so they're okay. But I think they're okay in the same way a lot of overt stutterers are okay, right? That, like, you know, stuttering is just not a big part of their life, and so they don't think about it. They might have these habits that have become automatic that, you know, aren't the healthiest of habits, but at this point in their lives, it's not worth it to them to do anything about it.
That all makes total sense. Will you allow me one last point on this topic?
Absolutely.
So this is Stutter Talk. I'm Peter Reitzis here with Dr. Christopher Constantino. So, Chris, sometimes a child will have an IEP because they've outgrown their stuttering. So the on paper, it says they stutter, but they don't stutter anymore. And sometimes a child will have an IEP that says they stutter, but they never stuttered. But here's the problem with both of those situations. Well, besides the fact that you're pulling a child out of the classroom to help them with something that they don't need help with, you can have, and these are all real experiences I've had, you can have a child who has an IEP that only has stuttering on it. So the special education team and the parent can say, well, at least they're getting something. So maybe the child is referred because of possible learning disabilities. And they have a full evaluation. And while there are big pockets of challenges for the child, they don't qualify for issues that I don't want to get into now. It's complicated how things are scored. States have different regulations. But a child is struggling with math and or reading in school, but they just miss the numbers. They don't quite qualify for learning disabilities, so they will get nothing. But the speech language pathologist says, oh, I hear a little stuttering. And the team is super eager to say, oh, okay, they'll get something. So now you're treating a child for stuttering that really doesn't need any stuttering treatment. And somehow the parent thinks, oh, they're going to be working on reading. But you're not working on reading. And then you have an IEP meeting and the parent says, oh, well, I'm still concerned about the reading and math. Yeah, but they didn't qualify for those services. So you're having an IEP meeting for stuttering and nobody wants to talk about stuttering. Unfortunately, I've seen this with children with anxiety issues, with serious mental health issues, even what we could say is mental illness. I've heard families say, well, if they get stuttering, that at least that's something because you're a man and she or he doesn't have a dad and we'd love for a man to be in this child's life. And now you're treating a child for stuttering, but that's not really what you're doing. Have you come across any of this and all the problems that these bring?
I've certainly been in the situation in an IEP meeting where the team is trying to figure out how to get this child services with the diagnoses that the child carries. And they don't quite carry the correct ones for the services that the team thinks the child needs. And so certain services are trying to piggyback on diagnoses that they're not appropriate for. I have been in that situation, and I don't know about you, but it makes me really uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah. 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 I've been in situations where I've said to people, there's a lot of speculation. This child has a mental illness. It's an uncomfortable conversation to have with a family. But we can't call this stuttering just to give the child an IEP. That's not what we're doing here today. And, you know, there is this thought like, you know, this is hard. The parent, and this is just an example. It doesn't have to be mental illness. It could be another issue where, oh, well, we know this family. They're not going to get their child tested for attention deficit. They're not going to get their child a medical evaluation for X, Y, and Z. But I heard someone say like, oh, do they stutter? Well, then they'd get something. Then they'd be in the system. Then they'd have an IEP. Then we're monitoring them. Yeah, but he or she doesn't stutter. Please, I felt like I cut you off there.
No, I wasn't going to add much more than to say that I think in the same way that we need to be honest with the parents of our clients and with our clients themselves, that we cannot cure stuttering, right? If the child's past a certain age, that they're going to continue to stutter, and what we're going to do is help them to speak as easily and enjoy speaking as much as they possibly can. I think we also need to be honest with our parents and with the rest of the IEP team that, one, them receiving stuttering therapy is not going to help them with their other issues. And two, if they truly need help with those other issues, this is sort of obscuring it, right? That this isn't actually addressing the problem at hand.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that's a great place to leave it. I want to thank you, Chris, for joining us again on Stutter Talk.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me, Peter.
I hope that was okay. I hope that went the way that you wanted or that we wanted.
Yeah, I think it went great. You were articulating things at the start of the episode about how you're approaching your IEP meetings and speaking to the parents and to the team in a way that I hadn't quite formulated it like that in my head, in terms of thinking about stuttering, not just in terms of does it exist or does it not exist, but is it disabling the child or not disabling the child? And because I think how I often would, and I sort of articulated this at the start, is I often think, okay, if they do stutter, I'd like them to have an IEP just so I can put them, I can give them accommodations if they need it.
Right.
But you added this nuance that I think is probably really helpful, even in private practice settings, that I think I might start talking to my students about in terms of, is it disabling? And if it isn't, what are we really offering this student and this family?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a showstopper of a statement. It really makes people think. And with articulation too, if we are, and this happens more than with stuttering. A parent contacts us about a child, their child, and they want to make sure they're covering all their bases. And will you listen to their speech? And maybe they push a bit and they want services. And I say to them, well, do you think your child is a disabled speaker? And the heavens no is almost always the response. Well, but our role is to work with children who are disabled. So I understand you want your five-year-old to say the letter S, but we agree it's not a disability that right now they can't say the letter S.
It goes so, especially with articulation, it goes so far beyond that. I mean, I used to work in a middle school. I had eighth graders who were still struggling with their R's, right?
Yes.
But,
yep.
You know, there was nobody was making fun of them. They could communicate perfectly. They were intelligible, 100% intelligible. And they were carrying those IEPs into high school.
Yep.
So not only are they getting pulled out of high school classes, which are difficult, and so there's the impact on the child, which is probably negative because they're getting pulled out of their classes. There's the impact on the district, which is having to pay to send SLPs out to a high school to work on something that doesn't need to be worked on. And it's just this cascading effect when there's really no disability present.
Mm. Yes, I completely agree with you. And, you know, if sometimes I think our field, probably all fields, not just our field, but sometimes I think speech language pathology needs an outside audit, someone to come in and look at what we're doing and to sort of shake us a bit and say, what are you doing here? I mean, like, don't get me started on what it takes, the paperwork we have to do. I mean, we waste so much time. Like, you never waste your time on a child, but you waste your time on paperwork trying to explain to the world why you should or should not be seeing this child to help them. We desperately need an outside audit to help us better manage our time and how we help people. So can I keep this in the show, or do you want this to be off air?
No, you can add that in. I was actually just thinking, I wish that was that part of the conversation was part of the show.
Good. So we're going to leave it in. And in pure Stutter Talk fashion, this 20-minute topic is now 50 minutes, which is great. But let's wrap it up here. I'm so glad that you joined me for this, Chris.
Yeah. Thanks again, Peter.